Welcome to the intersection of theater and even more theater. You have achieved stage grok. Stage Grok, the roaming theater podcast, coming to you from the geographic center of the American Theater. I'm your host, Scott Miller. Today, I'm talking with Adam Feldman, theater critic for Time Out New York, on the phone from his office in New York.
Okay, so thank you so much for talking to me. I want to start by talking about what is Time Out New York? What kind of publication is it?
What is Time Out New York? Time Out is a weekly guide to arts and entertainment and other events in New York City, and it has now been going on for 20 years here. It started
Wow.
in London well before then, and it was a huge deal in London. They brought it over here, and it's been chugging along nicely here for 20 years now.
That's very cool.
I have been here for 11 or 12.
Nice. So as a theater critic in New York, I want to kind of go through your whole process. So I want to start with, obviously you can't see every show going on in New York. What are your criteria for deciding what you are going to see and not going to see?
Well, that's a good question. I can't see everything that happens here. I think people sometimes don't realize how many things are going on in New York.
Yeah.
There's a lot on Broadway. There's 40 Broadway theaters, and then there are dozens and dozens of off-Broadway theaters, each of which usually programs five or six things a year, or more. And then there are, hundreds of off Broadway theaters. I also write about cabaret music for the magazine. And
right.
So, I also see a lot of cabaret shows. And so, I actually see, I think, a lot too much, probably by any objective standard. And the danger for me, because I'm know-it-all by temperament, the danger is stopping myself from seeing everything, because if you see seven or eight shows a week, the risk of burnout is very high.
Yeah, I can imagine.
And there are times in the year when that's unavoidable. Around the April crush, especially in recent years, there are certainly weeks where I will be seeing 8 to 10 shows in a week. And then there will be shows, there will be times in the summer or in the midwinter when it's a lot less busy.
Is the April crush about Tony deadlines?
It's complicated. I actually wrote a piece last year about a little blog piece about it last year. It's mostly about Tony deadlines, and it's become really absurd in recent years. Last year, 40% of the whole Broadway season opened in 3 weeks before the Tony cutoff date.
Oh,
yeah, and that's insane.
And so is the thought that the later you open, the better you'll be remembered for nominations? Is that the point?
Yes, that's partly the point. And also, shows are just sort of trying to get in under the wire. Shows that, might ordinarily take an extra month to come in are all making a strong effort to get in a little earlier. So there's a finish line that's been set up kind of artificially by the Tony season. And a lot of shows now are making decisions based around that. And I think that it's unfortunate in a lot of ways, because a lot of those shows get lost in the end-of-season crunch. There's only so much press or attention or audience interest
right.
that you can get when they all open at once. And I think you see a number of shows that that get hurt by that. And certainly, as a critic, it's not ideal circumstances to have to turn around that many reviews and have to see that many shows in such a
yeah.
short period of time. You can't really take them all in.
Do you think that rush, that concern, however it's framed, it is detrimental to the material in some cases?
Yeah, sometimes. I mean, I do wonder sometimes whether shows that might benefit from another couple of months somewhere are artificially pushing their open dates a little too early because of this line in the sand. There's a conventional wisdom that things that open later in the season have a better chance at the Tonys, and to some extent that is true, but if the show is really good, then that's not as much of an issue. I don't think Hamilton is going to be very hurt by the fact that it opens early in the season. Hairspray, you know, shows of that ilk can do just fine for themselves. It's the shows that might be on the cusp that I think are more nervous about it. But to answer your first question, there are shows that I have to see and there are shows that I want to see. The shows that I have to see are shows that I'm reviewing, or shows that are opening on Broadway because I am a Tony voter and so I have to see everything that's opening on Broadway.
Oh, right. So you do see every show that opens on Broadway?
I absolutely do see every show that opens on Broadway, and I see a lot of the shows that open off Broadway, especially the ones, certainly the ones that I'm reviewing, and the ones that I'm not reviewing, there are artists and there are careers and there are groups that I want to track, and even if I'm not writing about them at that time, I want to see what they're up to so that the next time I have occasion to write about them, I can do so from an informed perspective.
Right.
And I'm on various committees that give out awards and those kinds of things. So the New York Drama Critics Circle, of which I'm the president, and the Actors Equity Awards committees for the Clarence Derwent Award and others. So I do try to see as much as I can, you know, but also I try to do so with an eye to not getting completely tired of the whole experience.
How often do you, you know, consider a show and think, boy, you know, this sure doesn't seem like my cup of tea, but I'll give it a shot, and, you know, and then you end up thinking it's
often,
awesome.
Yeah, no, often. The expectations game is a weird thing for critics as well as for audiences in general. I mean, I think that it's sometimes shows really benefit from low expectations or get hurt by high hopes. I do what I can to manage that because I am alert to it. It's something that I thought about, and I try not to read too much in advance, for example. But, you know, David Cody and I, David is the other theater critic here, and we both have been here for a long time, and we will generally divvy up the shows depending on our schedules and our interests. And I think it's fair to say that both of us try to see shows that we suspect we will have a better chance of liking.
Right.
Shows that we, you know, because whatever anyone might think about critics, very few of us, I think, are actually sadists. it may seem that way sometimes, and I understand that. In fact, it's much more satisfying to write about a good show.
Right, right. Well, I've had a number of critics say to me, they always walk into theater hoping that this is going to be awesome.
That is absolutely true, because it's only for selfish reasons, because sitting in the theater in a bad show is awful. bad theater is worse, is more uncomfortable than bad television or bad movies or most other bad art forms. Mm-hmm. It's deeply uncomfortable. You're right there. The performers are right there. You're part of the energy exchange. If it's not working, then you know it's not working, and they know that it's not working, and they know that you know that they know that you know that it's not working.
Right.
And, you know, and it's a painful place, and you don't, and it's also a more static art form generally, so it's not like the movies where at least what you're watching will be moving around a lot.
Yeah.
And you're stuck in place, and you have to behave because other people are participating in this event as well. And so you're frozen in place, and the show is more frozen than many other representational, you know, performative arts are. And so but with all of that in play, bad theater is extremely uncomfortable. And, you know, for critics it's a little better because we have the socially authorized option of writing notes, which can be a welcome distraction. But then you can start thinking about what is not working in the show. But to get back to what we were saying before, I mean, the real joy is seeing something that you love and trying to get a hold of why you loved it and share that with others and help them make decisions with their time and money and investment, you know, personal investment energy, and try to make the best decisions for themselves and see the stuff that you think is really sort of pushing the world forward. And the flip side of that is that you want to help people avoid spending bad nights at the theater because it is very uncomfortable and now very expensive.
Yeah.
And if people go to the theater and they have a bad time, then they're less likely to go again. And especially that's true if it's something that they've been told is good.
Right.
So, you know, there's a danger. You don't want to be a jerk when you're writing these reviews, but you also don't want to coddle bad work because it's bad for the system. And when people start moving into that mentality, and I've seen it in the cabaret world for sure, people feel threatened, people feel protective, and so you end up in a kind of a group hug mentality. And a defensive one, you know, it's also sort of a defending the fort mentality.
Right.
And you, and when people, when the art form is endangered, that's your natural impulse as someone who loves the art form. And I think most people who write about cabaret or theater do love those art forms. And so you want to, you know, protect it from the big bad world. But it, on the other hand, it is part of the big bad world. And sometimes, you know. And it's, you know, it's a, and it is a world to some extent of limited resources. So if you want to promote the stuff that you feel most strongly positively about, and sometimes that means also being critical of the stuff that you really think is not worth seeing.
Yeah. All right. Well, so let me go through the practical aspects. So you get to the theater. Do you take notes during the show?
I do.
What kind of notes do you take?
Well, the reviews that I write tend to be fairly short. So, you know, one of the interesting things that what I've realized is that I actually very rarely consult my notes after taking them. Because, you know, filling the three paragraphs doesn't usually require it.
I know in my case, it, when I write something down, that puts it into my memory.
Well, yeah, that's the thing, is I actually just feel like the process of writing it helps me, you know, helps me understand it and helps me focus on what is happening as it's happening. And
right.
I try to sort of track my interests or my questions about the plot, you know, my curiosity about the characters, and see how that works out. I also will flag lines that I find striking, and then I can go back and find them verbatim in the script. We do
both good and bad.
Yeah, both good and bad. We do get the script, which is useful.
You do get a copy of the script?
We do. You almost always get a copy of the script, and that is very useful. It frees you up from missing things on stage while you're trying to remember the exact quote. You can just sort of write a very paraphrased version of it and then find it later in the actual script.
Right.
And sometimes that is to praise a beautiful line, and sometimes that is to hang the play with its own rope.
I love that phrase.
You know, that's the ball game. I also, in my case, there's a physical detail because my memory for physical details is not as good as I would like it to be. I will sometimes make notes about exact set or costume details that I might otherwise be at risk of forgetting, or not forgetting, but of getting slightly wrong. I don't want to get things wrong. My great horror. I have a great horror of false correction. It's one of my greatest pet peeves in others, and certainly in myself. It's my great fear. So I really make a strong effort not to be flat out wrong anytime.
So this may be a silly question, but I'm going to ask anyway.
Sure.
Coming specifically and only from the musical theater. When you're going to see a musical, can you tolerate one of the elements not being too strong? You know, does strong music make a weaker lyric okay? Does a strong book make a weaker score okay? Or do all the elements really have to be all top notch?
Gosh, well, I mean, it depends. I mean, the complicated thing about musicals, as you know, is that there are so many elements in play.
Yeah.
And all of them kind of, for them, when a musical is really great, all of those musicals are working at full function. I mean, all of those factors are working at full function.
Right.
And when one of them is a little weaker than the others, or two or several of them are a little weaker, it can be okay if one of them or more are very bad or are distractingly bad, then it does pull the rug out from the whole enterprise.
Right.
And so I have a particular, I think probably sensitivity to bad lyrics.
Me too.
Yeah, they hit my ear really violently, and they certainly. I think I probably react more strongly negatively to bad lyrics than I do to bad music, because I think that bad music is maybe generic. And when I say bad, I mean a certain kind of obvious or generic bad.
Right.
Not
right.
You know, unusually.
Not interesting or exciting.
Monstrously terrible, yeah. But, I mean, just sort of the average subpar contributions. I think that I will, if the character and the lyrics are good enough, I think that the music can float by for me, whereas I think it's probably harder, in my case at least, to do that with lyrics. Bad lyrics really take me out of a song. I just give up.
Yeah, one of the weird experiences for me, I normally, if any of the elements are lacking, it's hard for me. It takes me out of it. But I'll always remember seeing The Producers really early in the run. And, you know, that score is not amazing. It's fine. Music and lyrics are fine. But overall, it was wonderful. And it was kind of, I think, the only time that it didn't bother me that some of the elements were just okay.
The Producers works like gangbusters. But it's also, I think that reflects a certain, it's a complicated question, but a lot of it has to do with genre and, and so something like The Producers or for that matter, to some extent, Book of Mormon, some of the rhymes are imperfect or obvious, but they're doing it on purpose in a comedic way, and that becomes part of the joke. So it doesn't hit the ear as badly as it does when you're in the middle of a deeply serious epic with comparably bad word setting, you know?
Right.
And also when the stakes are lower, I think I tend to be less critical of lyrics in sort of like a fluffy musical comedy or pop situation than I am when they're really trying to get at deep human pain, because I think that there's, and I think that's appropriate. I think that's an appropriate distinction to make. I think that there's a flatness and an embarrassment that comes out of a failed attempt at depth that does not come from something that isn't aspiring that high.
I totally agree.
You know, there's a question of aspiration and to some extent, you know, I remember I had a conversation years ago with Craig Lucas, the playwright, and he was complaining about how critics gave him a harder time sometimes when he was really trying to do serious or important things and would give a pass to things that were aiming low and succeeding. And that's a relevant point on his part.
Yeah.
I think we do that. I think that's part of the way that all of us engage. I mean, all audiences too engage in what we're seeing. If we go and decide we want to have a Big Mac, then you have a Big Mac, and it's fine. If you go to a fancy restaurant and they serve you a Big Mac, then it's the worst hamburger you've ever had.
Right. Yeah. That's funny.
But I mean, but that's part of how we experience it. You know, not. And so you do, you know, I do try to give extra credit to shows that are trying to do things that are difficult and new and original. And I will write the review differently, I think, or at least I'll try to write the review differently if I think that people are trying to do something really ambitious and failing,
right,
as opposed to trying to do something crappy and failing.
Right. All right, well, let me get back
surprisingly often.
Let me get back to your process. So you see the show, you take some notes. How soon after the show do you write? Do you let it percolate, or do you write right away?
Well, no, that I don't write that night because, you know, I'm at the office for, you know, 7 or 8 hours a day, and I'm at the theater. So I'm working for 12 hours, you know?
Yeah.
And I don't want to go home and continue that work. That's partly what my office hours are for. And although it can be sometimes tempting, it also, in the long term, would drive me even more insane. So I do try to do that in work hours. And deadlines I find very helpful. Sometimes they're a little too tight for comfort because we are on a production schedule, a print publication as well as a website, and that means that we have deadlines. And sometimes those deadlines are the day after the preview that we've seen, and that means
right.
it has to be turned around right away in the morning. And sometimes we have more time. And I prefer when we have more time because I think that my ideas about the play have time to mellow. If I've had a bad theater experience, I'm not as rawly annoyed by it. And if I've seen something that I love, I'm not as sort of immoderately excited by it. I can have time to think about what it was that I was responding to and try to put that in a fair context.
Yeah, well, you know, I totally get that. When I go see an amazing piece of theater, it's thrilling.
Yeah.
And I get very worked up about how much it's awesome.
Yeah, me too. And so there are times when doing that level of thrill will stay with you. It did for me with Hamilton, for example. And there are even times when it will grow, which is a lovely thing, you know, where something that is so good that it unsettles you or you don't know how to respond to it will grow in your estimation as you have time to think about it and think about why you had this response to it. And then there are many things that you'll like perfectly well and that will fade away within a week.
Yeah.
There are shows that I do not remember having seen that I look back on my reviews and say, oh, well, I seem to have really enjoyed it at the time.
Well, at least you have that record.
Yeah. And then there are shows that I was more ambivalent about and which it turns out have really stuck with me. You know, so it's, you know, there's always going to be a certain first draft of history quality to it. You can't get everything right away. And there is no, obviously, there's no objective right or wrong in all of these things.
Yeah.
I'm saying right or good or, you know, when I say all these things, it's with an implicit understanding, I hope, that we're talking about my opinion.
Right. Well, okay. So the review gets published. Do you often or ever hear from the people you're reviewing, and is it unpleasant?
not often. Well, you know, sometimes if I've written a very nice review, I'll hear from the person.
Just like a little thank you note.
Yeah, if I've written a positive review, then I will sometimes hear from the person. Artists, for various reasons, don't tend to respond to negative reviews. Some of them don't read them. Some of them do read them and pretend that they don't.
I think there are a lot of those.
Yeah, sure. You know, it's hard. You know, I would, especially actors, it's hard because it affects your performance. Even if it's a good review, it affects your performance. It's dangerous to read. So I understand why people either wouldn't read them or would deny having read them because there's a delicate balance of maintaining that confidence on stage. But there are people who read them, and there are people certainly who get upset. There at times we'll get an angry response, but you know, in most of those cases, it's led to an interesting exchange in my experience anyway.
That's cool.
With a couple of sort of late night, possibly having had a couple too many comments on the website. I would advise, generally, I would advise thinking a few times before posting, especially a public response to it. And not that to a negative thing. And that's true, by the way, of anyone. I tried very hard not to get sucked into criticism of my work when it happens. It's a quicksand situation, you know, especially in public, in social media and things like that. The more you struggle, the more you go down.
Yeah.
All right, so let me ask you one last question, which may be too big, but I'm going to ask anyway.
Oh, boy.
Give us your sense of the state of the American theater.
So the state of the American theater. Well, let's limit it to the state of the American musical theater.
Okay.
Because I think that's...
I'm happy to.
Yeah. I think it's actually in a very good state right now.
Yeah, me too.
And maybe the best that it's been in a long time. And... You know, I really became an adult in the 90s, and it was a time of great despair for those of us who love musical theater. And there was a sense that it was never going to come back, that it was dead and gone. And we would have a few little life cables that would be thrown our way, and we would cling to them. And then the culture has changed, and that's changed for a lot of reasons. And partly it was the success of things like The Producers, which made it sort of exciting and monetarily attractive again in the 21st century. But I actually think it's also part of a general cyclical cultural thing where people grew very uncomfortable with musical theater as an art form, sort of as the culture was changing into more of a culture of authenticity or at least a supposed authenticity, and the singer-songwriter movement and realism and film and television and all of these movements away from what had been a traditionally fairly artificial art form. And people became very uncomfortable with conventions such as breaking into song.
Yeah.
And not just uncomfortable, but actively hostile.
Yes.
where those things were derided and mocked and considered part of a very passe and old hat moment. And that has changed, and partly I think we see that reflected in modern pop music as well, where there was a lot of growth of just plain singers and away from that kind of personal expression movement that had dominated in the 70s. But I think that also we're seeing the flowering of seeds that have been a long time a growing. And I would give a lot of that credit to Howard Ashman, not just for Little Shop, but to Ashman and Alan Menken, to what they did in bringing the Disney musical back to life in the late and early 90s. And I think that that's underestimated in its long-term consequences.
I totally agree.
Growth. You know, but that moment grew up, you know, it watered a whole new generation of people who were comfortable with musical theater conventions. I mean, it had to do it at first through animation because it's distancing and it's safer.
Right.
And it also when it really was starting to grow back on Broadway, it often had to do it and continued to do it through certain types of ironic distance gestuality. Yeah, well, like Avenue Q or like Spring Awakening or Bloody Bloody Andrew Jackson or
Bat Boy or Urinetown
or Bat Boy Urinetown. Yeah.
There's so many.
Book of Mormon. But the irony is deceptive in some ways, because in many of those cases, the irony is, I think, more of an excuse to be able to enjoy the traditional virtues and values of musical theater storytelling.
Yeah.
And without the attendant embarrassment that was supposed to accompany it for many years. And now we're slowly, I think, moving out of that default embarrassment. And that is what permits the regrowth of very serious-minded and sincere and non-distanced forms of the art form as well. And so you can have things like Light in the Piazza and Carolina Change and Hamilton, for that matter, and or Next to Normal, you know, which are very serious and intent and which are not really winking very much. You know, Hamilton has an inherent thrill of dissonance that's involved in the difference between its form and its content.
Right.
But that doesn't function as weirdly as you'd think. It's not, people are enjoying that surprise that comes out of seeing hip hop come out of the mouths of people in 18th century. and you certainly get all of the charm and excitement and loquacity and you know, verbal ostentation and thrill of the hip hop thing, and that's part of the fun. But it's also basically a musical that is very much in the tradition of a long line of Broadway shows of various kinds. And Lin-Manuel Miranda is deeply entrenched in that culture, in musical theater culture.
Yeah.
Absolutely unabashed of it.
Yeah.
which is so awesome.
Yeah, it is. And that's why you're seeing, you know, you're seeing people come to it now. You're seeing the people like Duncan Sheik. You're seeing the people like Sarah Bareilles, who's coming in with a new show. You know, Steve Martin and Edie Brickell have a show coming up. Cyndi Lauper, obviously. I mean, you know, it's more attractive when it's less embarrassing to the world. you know, and that's something that's become possible for a lot of reasons. It's also become enormously profitable again. So shows like Wicked and shows, you know, like Book of Mormon and The Producers make the genre very attractive again for talented writers and artists. And it gives them, I mean, we do live in a capitalist system. It gives them a motivation to want to work in this field.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me. This has really been fun, and I think it's cool for people to get insights into what critics think about theater and want from theater and so forth. So, yeah, this has been really cool.
Well, you know, any time, my pleasure.
Thank you for joining us. This is Scott Miller. Now you, too, have achieved stage grok. See you next time.